Hey folks, Scott Weingart here, and this is an MCRIT podcast. Podcast 151, to be exact about it. Today, we're going to do a little procedural sedation discussion. This, I guess, will be the third lecture on procedural sedation on the MCRIT site. And today, I'm bringing on a guest. Before we get to who that is, let me just tell you about a course I am doing in September. It is the New York City Airway course with Rich Levitan. I went to this course for the first time last year. Amazing, absolutely phenomenal course. This is the advanced version. This is where we go over things like endoscopes and rhinolaryngoscopy and awake intubation. It's Rich, it's myself, Ken Butler, and then George Kovach, who you've heard on the show, and Adam Law, who do the best course in Canada on airway management. So now you're basically getting the compilation of the faculty of the best courses on earth for airway management. Check it out. It's September 19th and 20th of 2015 in New York City at the World Trade Center. Let's get to today's guest, Jim Miner. He's the chief of emergency medicine at Hennepin, and he has done an insane amount of research on the area of procedural sedation in the emergency department. And that's what we're going to talk to him about today. Let's get right to it. Thank you so much for doing this.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
I guess the first question is, you have a patient come in with a prosthetic hip. It's dislocated. Walk us through exactly how you would go about providing the procedural sedation. Let's say you had at your place an orthopod who's going to do the actual reduction. So you don't have to worry about that at all. Your goal only is to take optimal care of this patient. What are you going to do beforehand? What are you going to do for preparation? How are you going to sedate the patient? And what are you going to do afterwards?
That's a great question. So when I'm looking at a patient like this, the first thing I'm thinking of is what's their baseline medical status? Are they otherwise really, really healthy? Or are they otherwise really, really sick? And that's where I make my main steering point. A person who's completely stable but has a really painful procedure coming up, it's a much different discussion than, you know, the unstable patient who's going to have a painful procedure coming up. On the stable side of things, first thing I do is talk to my proceduralist, or if it's me doing the procedure, think about how long it's going to be. Their person's going to need to be sedated, because if it's going to be something we can do in a 2 to 3 minutes, this is a much safer procedure, and you can use a little deeper level of sedation pretty safely. If it's going to be something that's going to take quite a long time, then we know that risk increases as the duration gets out. So then I start thinking, you know, much more about the risk of procedure and what agents I'm going to use. But really, that first thing is I get their pain under control first, just to a baseline they can lie in bed comfortably. They're squirming around. It's just hard to decide how much pain mass they're needing. So I get them comfortable just sitting there before I even start. Once I'm done with that, then I move on to sedation.
All right. So you do some preemptive analgesia. You give the patient a few rounds of morphine or hydromorphone, and now they're relatively comfortable before you start yanking on them. And their medical history is they have a history of hypertension and diabetes, but nothing horrible and nothing that actually is bearing on why they had the hip dislocation. So nothing active going on.
Yeah. So then my go-to agent is generally propofol. For a short procedure, 2 to 3 minutes at a single bolus, it's hard to get anything any safer than that. And when we look at anything else, everything else we try ends up being a little bit more dangerous in that stable patient at a single bolus. Everything changes the longer you use propofol and the sicker the patient is before you start. But in a good stable patient, it's great. So once I have their pain adequate for them to sit there, we get them all lined up. In terms of setting up, I usually pre-oxygenate people. It's been studied, and there really, honestly, isn't good evidence for it making any difference in the long run. Ken Deitch done some really cool research, and really, we haven't found a good reason to do it, but I don't have a good reason not to do it, other than that the O2 sat monitor is not very effective when somebody's pre-oxygenated and telling you whether or not the person is breathing anymore. So I get, for that reason specifically, I get them on end-tidal CO2 at the nasal cannula, then I get them on high-flow oxygen, look at their respiratory waveform, get a feel for what they're looking like, then a bolus of sedative. I try to hit people in the 1 to 1.5 per kilo range and get the whole procedure done as fast as I can. One of the cool things we found in one of our studies on recall is that people had about 1 to 1.5 minutes of retrograde amnesia when we pushed more than 1 per kilo of propofol into them, meaning we could get going pretty quick, even when they're still talking to us and they wouldn't remember things afterwards. What we found on the other end, though, is if we do painful stuff to people as they're coming off the propofol, even though they're only marginally conscious when we're doing it, they form pretty good memories of it. So we try to get everything front-loaded in the procedure. So I get going almost as soon as that propofol is in, if I don't need them more relaxed. As soon as they're relaxed enough to do it, I get going. And I try to leave them alone as soon as the procedure is done for as long as I can, just to prevent that recall.
That's fantastic. And it brings up a point that I wanted to discuss with you, which is your research specifically changed my practice about using periprocedural opioids. I used to always give fentanyl along with my propofol, and it was your work that actually got me to only using pre-procedural analgesia. Can you talk about that a little bit, Jim?
Yeah, you know, it makes a lot of sense that we want to give an opioid because propofol works a lot better when people in pain are, you know, aren't in a lot of pain. The first thing that kind of got us thinking about this is when we looked at people who did and didn't get opioids with the propofol at the same time, not in a study, just retrospectively looking at our own practice, we saw that respiratory depression rate was a lot higher in that group we were giving the opioids to beforehand. It made us start to wonder about our practice. Then we did these recall studies and realized that we had people talking to us and yelling and screaming who afterwards were saying, "Doc, that was great. I don't remember a thing." So like, well, you know, how bad is it for that to hurt for a second if you don't remember it afterwards? There's great data out there showing that untreated pain in a prolonged painful procedure is really bad for patients. That's just as well established almost as any fact we know in pain management. But we don't have that information for the really, really short-term stuff. So we started looking at brief painful procedures. Started looking at one of my colleagues, Jeff Ho, does a lot of law enforcement research, and they study a lot of really short-term, really painful things. We started looking at the acute effects of, you know, pepper spray and tasers and things like that. And we started looking at our own patients who were getting these brief procedures and trying to look for catecholamine rises, changes in physiology that would make us think that these brief painful, brief bursts of pain that aren't later recalled would have an effect on them. And we just couldn't find anything. At the same time, we were studying, well, what happens to their physiology when we give them these extra pain meds? And we do see that more blunting of their end tidal waveforms, more respiratory depression, more apnea episodes. And when we looked at those same stress measurements we were using to try to assess the effects of brief pain, we found that actually we were seeing a lot more stress from that respiratory depression than we were seeing from the pain itself. So when we looked at it, we were getting catecholamines on patients that were getting propofol with and without a burst of alfentanil with it. We saw that the patients who were getting the alfentanil had stressful episodes, but it was more related to their respiratory depression. Sure enough, even the patients in propofol group had a stress response to the respiratory depression, but we didn't see it from the short period of pain.
That's fantastic stuff. Your most recent work actually looked at a lot of people who still want to give analgesia would say, well, I'm not going to use an opioid. I'll get synergistic responses on respiratory depression and hypotension potentially. So I'll use ketamine instead. What was your most recent work? What did it demonstrate on that topic?
Well, you know, that makes so much sense physiologically, and we were really excited to study it because, I mean, really, ketamine did sound like a better way to go on this one. And so we mixed the ketamine in. We did three different doses. We did straight propofol, a one-to-one combination of ketamine and propofol given together, and then a three-to-one, three times propofol to one of one part ketamine. And really what we found is that one-to-one group of ketamine and propofol was a lot different than the other two groups. Their sedation onset was a little different. They didn't get quite as deep, and the offset was much, much longer. And we didn't really see a big difference in their pain response. I assume they had less pain response, but really nothing we could palpate. The 3-to-1 group actually did pretty well. Nothing I could pick up in our study, but as just clinically using it, it was pretty good. They came off very, very nicely because they had a subdissociative dose of ketamine. So it was just working as a pain medicine, as far as I can tell. It seemed to be pretty good, but again, it was nothing the study could pick up. Just a slightly longer duration before they got back to their baseline mental status. So we didn't come up with good evidence. You know, a lot of discussions I was having with people as I presented this work at meetings, and then a couple of interesting emails I've gotten since it's gone out, people said, you know, maybe we should be talking about ketamine the way we talk about opioids. We give a smaller dose than we've been talking about before, a subdissociative pain dose before we even get started, get their pain under control with ketamine, and then try propofol. And that might be an approach that, you know, I'm really interested in looking at in the future if somebody's not already doing it.
That's fantastic. Let's talk about a slightly controversial topic that the case we just mentioned somewhat brings up, which is the planes of anesthesia discussed by CMS and emerging from the anesthesia societies would tell us that we should be doing deep sedation as the furthest we go. And if we slip into general anesthesia, yes, we can handle it, but that was suboptimal. And yet when you look at the definition of deep anesthesia, it means the patient is reacting to pain, which is the antithesis of what I want when I'm doing a painful procedure on a patient. How do we reconcile this?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think it's really how you define that response to pain. When we're targeting somebody, especially for like a hip reduction, they need to be pretty well sedated for 2 or 3 minutes. You know, the response we want is we don't want them fighting us when we're trying to pull that hip back. But at the same time, we probably want to look for some sort of physiologic response, whether it's just a deep breath. That gets them into a definition of deep sedation because it's a response to pain. That being said, though, it's just well known that when you do deep sedation, you're going to end up in the realm of a patient who could have been defined as general anesthesia. The difference really is in your target. So when we're trying to sedate someone who isn't intubated in the ED, we probably should be targeting that they'll have some response to pain at some point. Knowing that, doing that, we're going to overshoot that on a regular basis. We tried to study this about 10 years ago. We randomized people to moderate or deep sedation. We found that about a quarter of them in both groups ended up not really responding to pain in a meaningful way. So, you know, knowing that this is a little harder to do than we think, that, you know, a quarter of the time, whether even if you're trying to keep the person's eyes open during the procedure, they're probably going to end up generally anesthetized at some point during the procedure, one a quarter of the time. I think we just have to know that and be ready to manage their airways and really only have deep sedation in the hands of people that intubate on a regular basis, which it's a big part of emergency medicine. It's a big part of critical care. This is well within the skill set of the docs doing it, but I think that target can be important. If you target general anesthesia, you're definitely going to get it. You'll probably get apnea more often than you want.
What are the biggest mistakes you see made in emergency medicine when deep procedural sedation is being done?
That's another great question. You know, the biggest mistake I see is forgetting how long it takes for a sedative to kick in. So when I watch somebody sedating and I know they're going to cause apnea, it's because they give a dose of propofol, wait 15 to 20 seconds, which can feel like a really long time at the bedside. Say, oh, he's not down yet. I'm going to push another half that dose again. And then sometimes we'll even do that a third time, and they're still not at the first minute. And propofol really peaks 60 seconds out, even 90 seconds, some people will say. But personally, it feels more like about 60 seconds to me. To give all three of those doses, then about a minute after that, you end up with a very apneic patient. That's just kind of the standard mess up. I see is just not taking that full minute in between. It's going to be hard to do sometimes. It's why I like to go a little aggressively on my first bolus, knowing that if I did overshoot it, at least it's going to wear off in 3 minutes. Every time you give that dose of propofol, you know, the next bolus you give, it's going to take a little bit longer to wear off than the last one as you start to saturate the tissues.
Now, on those lines, this elderly patient with a hip dislocation, you started with your standard dose of 1 to 1.5. Some people advocate on the elderly going much slower. And I must say, on some of my patients, I've been remarkably surprised on how low the doses of propofol get them to the plane of anesthesia I'm looking for. Has this been your experience?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And you really have to keep track, especially in the elderly, of how much opioids they've gotten with it. Because when people have opioids on board, and you give some propofol to them, it has a bigger effect, especially in terms of the respiratory effect. I think the amnesia effect is pretty absolute to the, but your apnea is much more profound when you've got opioids on board. In elderly, it's really hard. Also, another group that's really difficult is the obese. You know, when we're talking about 1 per kilo, that's just a gross estimate, basically made by talking to, you know, everyone that was using propofol at the time and figuring out what doses they seemed to think worked. It wasn't figured out in a more constructive fashion than that. When you have a very, very thin patient, they need a much bigger dose. Probably it's, you know, we're talking 1.5 to 1.75 of ideal weight is the right dose of propofol. We just assume that everybody's got, you know, 14 to 20% body fat, and that gets us a little closer to one. And you get into kids, and you always have to go higher because they tend to be thinner. In a really heavy patient, or a person with a lot more adipose making up their body composition than muscle, they're going to need a smaller dose. But we don't have a good formula for it. I try to estimate, what I use in my head is I try to estimate their ideal weight, and then I add about a third of the rest of their weight to that and come up with my dose that way.
That sounds pretty reasonable. And I guess in any of these populations, if you didn't want to use formulas, you could just dose incrementally, understanding you have to wait to see the full effects.
Absolutely. You can always, I mean, it's one of the nice things about propofol in particular is that it is additive. It just, as you get closer and closer to the dose that gets them sedated, your first doses are going to be wearing them off sometimes. And if you give too much, then it starts to last a little bit longer. But I think giving smaller doses and working your way up is the way to go. As long as you keep in mind the fact that you've got to give it a full minute for the last one to fully kick in.
Absolutely. All right, let's do some rapid fire situations and see what you do, and then we'll go into some other questions. What's your go-to for cardioversion?
Great question. Etomidate still. When I give propofol to the cardioversion situations, I tend to make them sicker right away. So I've started to stay away from it. I used to use a lot more etomidate 10, 15 years ago for procedural sedation, but all the myoclonic jerking had me kind of move away from it in orthopedic procedures. I'll still use it in critically ill. But it's still my favorite drug for cardioversion.
Me too. All right, how about a chest tube? In a not crashing trauma patient, but one who might have had a little bit of blood loss, maybe they have a little bit of a hemothorax and a scalp laceration that bled, they already got a liter of saline and their blood pressure is okay, they're a little bit tachycardic. What would you use in that patient?
Again, I'd go to etomidate. I think that's where it's that drug is still the best one we have in a patient who is going to get unstable when we give them propofol. You know, if somebody's a little bit sick and I can get them really volume optimized, then I'll go to propofol because it's easier to work with than etomidate. But if I can't get if I'm not going to get them volume optimized or really really sure that they're not in any sort of perfusion stress, I'll stick with etomidate and try to do it in a single bolus. Etomidate's hard to give an extra bolus to. And that jerking really can get in the way of procedures. And we've always got the questions about what it's doing to their cortisol and stuff that I haven't seen a satisfactory answer on single boluses yet. But I still think it's probably safer in a patient who's going to get unstable from the propofol to stick to etomidate.
Fair enough. So when does ketamine come into your armamentarium?
That's a great question. I'm trying to figure that out. I think ketamine is a good drug for a lot of these patients. It's really nice for their blood pressure. It's really good for their respiratory status. As long as we don't push it IV, if we get into some trouble with ketamine if you push it too quickly IV with some more apnea than even we see with propofol if you push it fast enough. But the blood pressure tends to stay well. The downside of it is it's a little bit longer on the sedation end than you need sometimes. If I can handle a patient being down for 10 or 15 minutes, I just push it in really little bits. So say I want to give a patient, they're an 80-kilogram patient, and I want to get a chest tube in them, I'd probably give it in 20s, 2 or 3 minutes apart, and work my way there and give it as soon as they're ready to give it. Much different than the way I would bolus propofol because I want to give the bare minimum of it, and I want to push it pretty slowly just because when we did a comparison of propofol to ketamine, we were shocked to see how much apnea we caused with the ketamine by pushing it too fast.
Absolutely. Let's pull back a little bit from that. And there's been two articles now, very small case series, on the use of nasal CPAP as an augmentation of procedural sedation, for instance, in patients with obstructive sleep apnea. What do you think about that, Jim?
I think it's a really interesting idea. I haven't done that yet, but it makes a lot of sense to me physiologically, especially in a patient that you know has sleep apnea is at high risk. I don't see why. I certainly can't see that it would hurt, and it makes a lot of sense that it would help. I can't wait to see more work on that. And I want to try to give it a try when I see the right patient.
All right, let's talk about the topic that actually brought this podcast to happening, which was a listener wrote into the show about a lecture they had heard from you, and there might have been some degree of misinterpretation, but I think it was on the topic of a head injured patient and what to do in post intubation sedation for those patients. Can you talk to us about that, Jim?
Yeah, that's a. You know, the question really was, is we've got a patient who's got an altered level of consciousness from a head injury. We're intubating them. We want to sedate them. What's the priority of giving them sedatives? We know that not sedating somebody and giving pain medicines over a long period of time isn't good for them. And we have an inkling of evidence that makes us think that brief bits of pain or distressing events that you don't later recall don't cause damage that we can measure very well yet. Not the way we can measure bad outcomes from head injury from bits of hypotension. So Michelle Byros is one of my colleagues who studies head injuries, and I went back and looked at just as much data as we could pull on our stable room. I've been doing some shock research with tissue perfusion monitoring the last few years. We just had a lot of leftover data. We went and looked back at everybody who had a head injury to look at the perfusion and found, sure enough, everyone we gave a propofol tube in particular, after we intubated, had a pretty good 5 to 15 minute burst of decreased perfusion consistently. And it went away as, you know, you can picture the clinical scenario, right? You get the patient with a head injury, you intubate them. They then start to cough a little bit. You paralyze them. You give them some propofol for sedative. Oh, look, the pressure's now a little softer than it used to be. It went from 110 to 95. You give them a little fluid and you correct it. But that little blip there was a pretty big drop in perfusion, which we have really good evidence to show is not good for head injury. So as we looked at this further, we realized we were actually causing a problem, fixing something that we didn't know was bad for somebody. So we're giving somebody sedatives before we've really fluid optimized them or stabilized them. We might be hurting them in the setting of head injury. So our approach has changed a little bit in that we, you know, it's still a priority for us to get pain medicines and sedatives into people who are intubated, but we make sure first that we're going to keep them stable, that they're fluid optimized. Or we're starting to look more at drugs like ketamine, where we don't have that pressure drop. Now, ketamine has a long and kind of confusing picture in the world of head injury. It's come out on top and it's come out underneath a lot of times. But I think certainly when you have a patient who's paralyzed, there's no reason to think the ketamine's bad for head injury. And I think it would probably help us avoid that pressure drop. So we either need to get them fluid up or we need to use a different drug than propofol in those patients.
Jim, you have any experience using remifentanil for procedural sedation in the ED?
So remifentanil is so short-acting, you have to kind of drip it in to get any procedures done. I've had a little more luck personally with alfentanil, which is a slightly longer half-life at that first dose. So I've been using alfentanil at around 15 to 20 mics per kilo. And we dose it about half of it, and if the person's still breathing well, we give the other half. And that gives us about 3 to 4 minutes of pretty intense opioid effect. Usually a little apnea in there, but if you're doing a painful procedure, patients get, they do pretty well with it. We've been studying propofol versus alfentanil for moderate sedation for a couple of years. And really the interesting thing we found, we're still not done yet, but just as I peruse the results, everyone we give the alfentanil pill still remembers the procedure, but they're satisfied with it. They said, oh, that wasn't so bad. Yeah, it was painful, but I didn't mind it. Everyone we give propofol to doesn't remember the procedure, but they're not as satisfied with the entire event. I think it feels people get kind of they imprint the memory of the procedure as not that bad when they've got all the alfentanil on board when you do that painful procedure. It's a very different situation. It works really well in procedures that aren't get repeated. I think patients are a lot less scared of it and more compliant. I mean, you can probably use less and less drugs. So somebody needs a couple LPs or a couple burn dressings, or maybe you're going back into to relook at an IND from a few days before that needs a packing change, is going to be really painful. I think there's a lot of good use for those short-acting opioids there, but remifentanil has been tough because you have to keep them on a drip the whole time, which again adds so much work that it starts to get hard to use.
Fantastic. Anything else you want to add before we go, Jim, about procedural sedation in the emergency department?
No, I think really the next big change I see coming in the future is there's different kinds of perfusion monitoring come out, cerebral perfusion monitoring, peripheral. I think this is going to give us even a better, we've been looking for the right monitor to tell us when not to give the next bolus or when to do something about it. And my impression is that these monitors are going to, in the next few years, give us a little bit of an edge where we're going to have a little bit better clue than we get from NTIDAL or blood pressure or anything else that we're getting into trouble on these sedations.
Fantastic. We can't thank you enough for coming on the show, Jim. This has been an absolute pleasure.
It's my pleasure. Thanks a lot.